You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.
Welcome to Radio Primavera Sound. My name is Ben Cardew, and I'm very happy to present to you an interview I did with a legend of punk, post-punk, indie music, just a legend of music, Peter Perrett, who was once, of course, of The Only Ones and who is now a fantastic solo artist. His new album, The Cleansing, is probably the best album of his career. It is full of depth, wisdom, and gallows humour. I totally, totally recommend you go and listen to it. We spoke in Barcelona before his recent gig, and if the audio quality is a little suspect on my side, it's because I was wearing a mask. Peter has had a lot of health problems. He wasn't feeling his best that day. He was worried about his voice for the gig, so I definitely masked up, which is obviously more important. Anyway, the important thing is, who cares about my voice? Because you want to hear Peter Perrett, as you very much should. We talked about everything from being a parent to mortality to do not resuscitate notices, lots and lots and lots of things. I really enjoyed doing the interview. The gig was fantastic, and I really hope you enjoy it. But look, thank you so much for doing this. As I was saying before we were recording, I think your new album, The Cleansing, is my favourite of your solo albums. I think it's an amazing piece of work. And it seems like a very telling name. I mean, what do you mean by it? Do you feel cleansed?
I've been completely clean of any contaminants since April 2011. I feel like a newborn baby in that sense, and discovering all my senses at once, which makes me oversensitive, over emotional, just feeling things, laughing, crying, enjoying interaction with other human beings. So from a personal view, but also it's brought into sharp relief the way the world has changed in the time that I was last really awake, which was in the 70s. I think over the last 50 years, it has become a bit of a horror show. And I would like to think that there is an imminent cleansing. I can't see any hope for it anywhere, because everything seems to be going in the opposite direction. But without hope, I think it'd be a pretty depressing existence. So, it's like the way I feel personally, and also wishful thinking for the future.
But it feels to me as well like a very wise record. To give an example, on Back in the Hole, there's a line: we all try to be good parents, but in the end, we got to shoulder the blame. That seems like a very wise thing to say.
Say that again.
We all try to be good parents, but the end, we got to shoulder the blame.
Yeah, well, it's the burden of fucking parenthood. It's difficult, especially during the time that we were parents early on in their lives. They lived a very dysfunctional life, and you always worry that that dysfunction has affected them in an adverse way. So any little character defects that emerge, you feel responsible for. There are pluses and minuses from having children. The plus is that they can play lead guitar, bass guitar. The minus is that you feel their pain. And feeling the pain of your children is the greatest pain you can have.
I think one of the things I really like about that line, and something that comes across a lot in the album, is it's like, I mean this in a good way, but you know how like rock music was always, at its start, it was a teenage music, it was for teenagers, and that was like the subject matter. But that feels like a very mature line, if you see what I mean. But it's not like, it's not sort of, mature sounds boring, but that's not what I mean. Do you know what I mean?
I think, like, obviously, it's easy to have fun when you're young. You're focused on the present, don't think about the past or the future. I think when you're older, it might not be as much fun in certain ways, but some people achieve an amount of wisdom that comes with self-reflection And so, you know, I've got 70 years to reflect upon, and I think I'm capable of writing lyrics that are self-deprecating. You know, I don't think I'm the greatest, most intelligent, most talented person in the world anymore, which I thought when I was 25. You know, there's a certain arrogance with you, that comes with youth. You think you're indestructible. You think the world is there just for your pleasure. Yeah, so I think an advantage of writing songs at my age is that I've got a different perspective. And like mature is not necessarily a critical word. You know, sometimes it can give the listener the advantage of experiences that they haven't experienced yet. Hopefully there'll be people my age that identify with the subject matter I write about. And there might be younger people who wonder what it's like to have lived my life.
You compared the album to Johnny Cash doing his best work.
No, I didn't compare the album.
Is that a misquote?
Well, it's when my record company Domino, they get somebody to write a biog. And the guy that wrote the biog picked up on a quote that I said in 2007. And in 2007, it's the first time, it was at the time of the Only Ones reunion. First time we'd played together for 27 years or something. And I said that I found Johnny Cash inspirational because the song Hurt was his best work ever, which he did just before he died. So I mentioned it in respect of that it is possible to do your best work right at the end of your life. And that was like an inspiration that I felt then, never thinking that I would actually start writing new songs again and get clear. Because at the time I was still using, and I was taking part in the reunion out of respect for the other three members of The Only Ones. But I was there physically, but not mentally. I had to wait until I stopped using my mood-altering substances, and because I need to feel passion. And if I'm taking drugs, I don't even touch a guitar, so I don't get anywhere near writing a song. But when I stopped taking drugs, I had a lot of time on my hands. There were guitars lying around, and it was a natural process. It was similar to the process of me when I was 17 and got my first guitar. And I'd like to think that the cleansing's the best out of the three albums. I'm proud of all of them, but with the cleansing, all 20 songs, because it was a longer process, that's why it became a double album, because it was the end of lockdown. You know, I caught COVID, broke my hip, so things got delayed. I wrote more songs. I had more time to concentrate on exactly how I wanted those songs to sound, and quite a lot of them were changed over that period. They started off a certain way that if they'd been done the way the first two albums were done, it would have been a different album. But quite a few of them I deconstructed completely and rethought, and that's why I'm particularly proud of the album, because it feels like it's really, really focused in a way that none of my previous work has been.
I think you said it was your most important album.
Every album is important because it signifies that I'm still here. And I definitely believe, you know, I say it quite a lot. I have a mantra: survival is a revolutionary act. I think if you can survive, that shows that there's a spirit within you that defies the system that tries to crush you. And
is it very different writing songs in your 70s to writing them in their 20s?
Yeah, because in the 70s, I didn't give a fuck. You know, I just wrote songs, but I was too busy having fun to analyze them or think, oh, could this song be better? You know, I just wrote a song. Sometimes we'd play the song that day without rehearsing it. You know, we'd at a gig, everyone would just jam along, and it was very instant. It's completely different now, because especially with the technology, you can revisit things and edit them, alter them. It's, you know, in the 70s, it was just writing a song, going into the studio, two guitars, bass and drums, and see what happened. Whereas this album, there was that, but like I said, I deconstructed some of the songs and took the drums off, you know, put a drum machine on, just little things that made it more fun for me, and I think made the album more varied. There's a song without any drums that's got a string quartet on it, which Carlos from Fontaines DC wrote the part, the string part.
Well, I was going to say, for example, that there are modern touches to the album. There are synth parts, for example.
Yeah. the synths, yeah, that's just Jamie's got a synth and he likes playing about with it. And what's great about, like, he put a bass synth on Women Gone Bad. And what's great is that, like, on the guitar, he can do anything on the guitar. On a keyboard, his best things are played with one finger. And there's something I like about the naive simplicity of those sorts of keyboard parts. They can be really, I appreciate minimalism a lot more than I did when I was young. When I was young, it was all about just doing it, making a loud noise, as crazy as possible, which is the way most of our live gigs were. You know, the Peel Sessions is my favorite album because that's just us live. I think in the studio it was a bit more controlled, but since it's quite a lot of that is Jamie, because he, as the producer, he had freedom to pull out one of his toys and experiment with it.
See, I find this very interesting. I've got two children. I mean, they're a bit younger, but I find the idea that both Jamie and Peter Jr. Play on the album, and Jamie plays guitar and produces. Peter Jr. is on bass. What's it like recording with your kids? I mean, do they do what you say, or do they?
With Peter, we don't even have to converse. I just know Peter's going to play the perfect bass. You know, he's very. Yeah, there's no friction at all with Jamie, because he's the producer. You know, for ages I had to, I always used to say, you're not allowed to do too many notes, because, like, obviously he can be a guitar hero. So it's like only certain places that I feel it's appropriate for that to happen. And, you know, most of the friction is like in the production part of it, where I'll make a suggestion. He knows it's not going to work, but I make him try it for hours anyway, and then usually agree with him. You know, occasionally, like, you know, maybe 3% of the time it might work and make the song better. So yeah, there's more. It's more give and take with Jamie. With Peter, Peter's just like one of, you know, the cliched quiet bass player. He just stands there playing rock solid, and it's a different dynamic with each of my children. But it's great playing with your children, because they were like my musical carers. You know, I was not in the best shape when I stopped taking drugs, and they're the people that encouraged me to start playing again. Because they had bands together, and like when they were rehearsing upstairs, they'd say, come on, Dad, come and have a play. And they gradually got me back into it.
When they said they wanted to make music, what did you think?
At that time, I wasn't thinking. Whatever kept them quiet. Do you know what I mean? Like, if like I was just in a room not wanting to be bothered, and there were instruments around that weren't being used, and they, you know, from at the age of 12, Jamie, well, he picked up the guitar at the age of, I think, 8 or 9, a homemade guitar. And it kept them from bothering us. You know, it kept them amused, kept them occupied. You know, some parents sit their kids in front of a television to keep them occupied. But I thought it was quiet. And I, you know, I started liking what I was hearing through the walls. And it gave me pleasure hearing them. You know, if I'd have known what I know now, I would have tried to discourage them, because being a struggling musician in this world is a hard place to be, which is what the song Art is a Disease is about. You know, because like 99.9% of artists are struggling. You know, it's like society. There's the 0.1% that make all the money, and everybody else just tries to break even if they're lucky. So from a parent, responsible parental point of view, maybe if they'd have been lawyers or stockbrokers or something, I'd feel more secure about their future. But so long, you know, music gives them pleasure, and as long as they can survive, then yeah, as I said, from a selfish point of view, it helps me because I don't have to look for guitarists or bass players.
Well, I was going to say, Art is a Disease includes the line, art's a disease that mocks the afflicted.
Yeah.
Do you ever think what your life would have been like if you hadn't got into music? Or is that just impossible? Was it just...
It's impossible. I mean, I would have had to, you know, there's the old joke, what do you call a musician without a girlfriend? Homeless, you know, and that's the truth. You know, Zena got me a job once and it lasted 3 hours, and it taught me that I was unemployable. And it cost me money to do the job, because the National Insurance stamp and the fare to get to the job on the train fare to get to the job came to more than I got paid for the 3 hours work. That taught me a very important lesson, that I couldn't fit into the way society functions in the normal way. So I had to find alternative ways. I never thought, when I started playing the guitar, it was purely for pleasure. I never thought of a career. It happened by accident. Zena was the one that had ambition, and she was, you know, instrumental in helping me form a band. And I never, at the time, and the only ones, when we broke up when I was 28, I never thought I've given up a career. It was always been pleasure and just having fun, and music was part of my lifestyle. It's only much, much later that I realized that bands that didn't break up had built a career and a brand out of it, even if there was only one remaining member in the band. I wouldn't be able to do anything else apart from music.
I wanted to ask about The Cleansing. It's obviously a very serious album, deals with very many serious things, but there's a touch of humour to it, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's serious subjects, but, you know, I have got a sense of humour. I probably laugh at darker things than most people can laugh at. So it's like very gallows humour and laughing at myself and the stupidity of my lifestyle choices. You know, all that time I thought I was having fun. I mean, you'd like to think that over a period of 35, 40 years, you'd start questioning whether this really was fun. But what can I say? You know, I've been incredibly stupid. And I suppose writing about that stupidity is somewhat cathartic. I try to look at it in a positive way, in as much as it supplied me with subject matter and hopefully amuses people with the humour contained within it.
Well, for example, I think Do Not Resuscitate, which is one of my favourite songs on the album.
Right.
There's a humour in there, right?
Well, it's reality. You know, both my wife and myself have got COPD, which is, she's got stage 4 emphysema, I've got stage 3 emphysema. So in hospital, she went into hospital in 2015 with pneumonia, double pneumonia, almost died. And they ask you if you want to sign a DNR notice, do not resuscitate notice. So they tell you your lungs are so damaged that if you went on a ventilator, you would never be able to come off it. And when you're told that, I don't think there's a choice. You sign a DNR notice because living on a machine is, you know, is a pretty, you'd be begging for someone to put you to sleep. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine, you know, existing in that state and not, you know, being suicidal. So, yeah, it's an easy choice. And then I had my DNR notice when I went in with COVID and they asked me, and I said, yeah, I want a DNR notice. And the other thing about that song is Bobby Gillespie sings the backing vocals on it. And he was doing, all the vocals were done at my place, Pathway. The moment he finished the backing vocals, he turned his phone on and got a call from a hospital in Glasgow saying his dad was in hospital and did he want to put a DNR notice on him? And like me, Bobby and Jamie just stared at each other dumbstruck because it was just so, you know, I don't believe in spooky stuff, you know, the supernatural, but it was just a very, very weird coincidence. And whenever I think of that song or hear it, that's the moment it's always brought into sharp focus.
Another song on the album, Killer Franco Spy, seems kind of relevant. We're in Barcelona. Is the sort of Spanish history, is that something that interests you, or where did that song?
Yeah, all history interests me, especially if it contains momentous political events. I didn't start off thinking I'm going to write a song about, you know, Franco or the Civil War. It started off with one line at the end of lockdown, sort of the summer of 2021. Bobby knocked on my door, and Warren Ellis was with him. And Warren said, "How, you know, I hadn't seen him for ages." He said, "How are you doing, Peter?" And I said, "I feel like I'm on my last legs." So that was the little morsel that eventually grew into a song. Because after they left, I just wrote down a line. I've been trying to crawl towards you on my last legs. I thought that was like a pretty great line. I'm very proud of small mercies that my brain gives me. And then coincidentally, I watched a film called The Lady from Shanghai. And the final scene in it was Rita Hayworth, who had been shot, trying to crawl towards Orson Welles. And the last words she said were, "Give my love to the sunrise." And that resonated. But earlier on in the film, a line really resonated with me, which was Orson Welles saying in admiration about a character, "He could kill a Franco spy with his bare hands." That really resonated with me because obviously I'm of the left politically, and I really admire the international brigades and everything that happened at that time. It's a very simple song lyrically. The other line, Amnesty, Amnesia, Pretend It Makes It Easier, refers to the 1977 Spanish amnesty law, which, the positives were that a few socialists were released from prison after a long time. But the bad side is that it absolved all the torturers and the criminals of any responsibility and prevented the loved ones of the people that had been killed and disappeared from ever finding their remains and having any closure. So, you know, amnesty, amnesia, pretending, I mean, okay, let's all be friends and start again. But it's hard to forget the past. I believe, you know, in people, you know, coming together, you know, people from opposite sides coming together, but not if it eradicates the truth. I think, you know, we have to learn from the truth, because it is so hard to find truth nowadays. People don't know history. It's constantly being rewritten by the victors. The mainstream media don't tell you the truth about any of the wars that they're promoting. And I should stop talking about politics, because it always gets me into trouble. It annoys at least half of the listeners. And, you know, my kids always say, don't talk about politics, religion, or football. So I'm going to try to stop that here.
It's interesting. I mean, I won't go into politics. It's interesting. The amnesia law is still it's still a live issue here. You know, okay. People still talk about it.
Oh,
still,
wow, really?
Yeah. Because, you know, people want to know where their grandparents exactly, are. You know, people. Yeah. There was a big issue recently where they took Franco's corpse from the big monument where it is,
yeah,
you know, buried, and took it elsewhere. Yeah, it's still very much alive.
I'm glad that people still care, do you know what I mean? Because yeah. I don't think, because, you know, like they always say, you've got to learn from history. And if you don't know the history of it, it's being, you know, not taught in schools or published in the mainstream media. That, I mean, I can't believe that, you know, it's still called the Bernabeu Stadium. I mean, yeah. Santiago Bernabeu was like a Franco person. You know, I'm surprised that the supporters don't rip it, you know, I don't know. But all they care about is the team in white winning, don't they? As long as they win, keep winning Champions Leagues, they won't complain about the name of the stadium.
Don't get me started on Real Madrid. Don't get me started.
No, I used to like them when Laurie Cunningham played for Real Madrid. Like, I was a big supporter. He was great.
You've been very generous with your time. I just wanted to ask one more thing, if I may, which is that I hope you've got many, many, many more albums in you.
I think that's being slightly optimistic. Well, I mean, if I get one more, because I've written, you know, over half of the next album. I've done the vocals and the rhythm, because the cleansing started off with just rhythm guitar and vocals. They were all done before, because I wasn't sure how long after my stint in hospital with COVID. I thought I'd better get those down quick. So that's my approach. So I've done the vocals and rhythm guitar for some of it. So hopefully that will see the light of day, but I don't tempt fate. I think I'm going to be here in a year's time. You know, I always think this might be the last gig I ever do in Barcelona.
Say The Cleansing is the last record. How would you feel about it and I really, really hope it isn't. I don't think it will be. How would it feel?
As an epitaph, yeah.
Yeah, because it feels
I'm really proud of it, and I think I've said some important things about the way I feel about certain aspects of life. And sometimes, like when someone dies, people that have never bothered listening to them before will come across like eulogies on social media and will listen for the first time. And I'd be happy to, you know, if fate decrees that, you know, I've reached the end of this perilous journey, I'd be happy.
Well, thank you so much, and long life to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.